and welcome to episode 79 of Foreign Correspondence, a podcast that brings you interviews with journalists around the world. I'm Jake Spring, a foreign correspondent with 12 years' experience in Brazil and China. It's been a while. What was going to be a couple months turned out to be a five-month hiatus. Basically, I went to the United Nations Climate Summit in early December in Dubai to cover that, and then I went straight into Christmas vacation and only got back to Brazil in mid-January. And then, question mark, for another 2.5 months. Journalism is a demanding job, and if push comes to shove, I gotta prioritize my job over the podcast, but man, sometimes time just flies by. In that time, I'm proud to say I won my second Overseas Press Club Award in 3 years. This time, it was for Best Environmental Reporting as part of a huge team that did a project highlighting how deforestation is driving humans into closer proximity with bats and threatening the world with new diseases that could jump from bats to humans. I led reporting out of Brazil for one of the five parts in the series. If you're curious to check it out, I'll post a link to it in the podcast description. It's a story that is just as relevant today as when we published it last year. Anyway, my long hiatus aside, I can assure you the podcast is going to keep going, as beyond today's episode, I have two others recorded and waiting to be edited that you'll see in the next couple of months. There are just too many more journalists I want to speak to give up anytime soon. And I want to make it to at least episode 100, since that's the episode where I'll be the one interviewed. For this episode, I spoke to Alden Wicker, an independent journalist and the author of To Die For, How Toxic Fashion is Making Us Sick, and How We Can Fight Back. She's also the founder and editor of the sustainable fashion website EcoCult, and has written freelance for a huge variety of publications, including Wired, Vogue, CNN, and The New York Times. Crazy as it sounds, I first invited Alden to be a guest on the show in 2021. My wife had been writing a climate change newsletter in Portuguese for a while and admired Alden's work and turned me on to it. Alden was then working on her book, which we'll hear all about in this interview. Back then, she understandably said to check back around the time she was done with the book, which was going to be in about another year. Of course, I then forgot about it for about 2 years. I'm very glad I eventually remembered because this is a great interview. Her book is done and has been out for almost a year, so she can give us the full story of how it went down from start to finish. For those curious about writing a book, she'll get into the nitty-gritty details, including how you get paid for a book and how she figured out the writing by working on one chapter at a time. We'll also talk about her fascinating and honestly pretty dark experience of gradually turning into an influencer, with all the strangeness and unpleasantness that came with that, and then how she was later abruptly forced out of that line of work. There's also some talk of drugs, sex parties, and how she might have been a gonzo journalist like Hunter S. Thompson if a few things in her career had gone differently. On both counts, it's probably turned out for the better, as she's become a successful author and is already thinking about her next book. So now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Alden Wicker, freelancer, editor of EcoCult, and author of the book To Die For. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Alden.
Thank you for having me.
To warm up a little bit, if you could set the scene for us, just tell us where you are, both physically around you and where geographically you are, and a little bit about what your last week of work has been like.
So I live in Brooklyn most of the time. I'm in my bedroom that I share with my husband. I usually work in my living room, but I think he's probably going to come home from work and start messing around in the kitchen. So, and I also spend some time in Vermont. We had a pandemic purchase of a farmhouse up there, and I had really big plans to turn it into my little writing retreat, which it was, but now real life has come rushing back in, and we're spending more time, way more time in Brooklyn than in Vermont at this point. But I still have like a long-term goal of being one of those many New Yorker type writers who live in Vermont full time and still have their heart and work in the city.
Yeah, that sounds like the dream. And if you ever need to get away and write something big like a book, I imagine it's a good to have a place to hole up outside the city.
Yeah, absolutely. My last week of work has been, well, the week before I actually was on a little vacation with my mom. And so I was doing that thing that you do when you're around parents where you're like trying to work, but they're continually poking you and being like, well, do you really, I mean, when do you think you could? And so I pulled back. I was really lucky that I just happened to get all my deadlines in before I left for that. And so there was just a little bit of stuff that I was doing every day. But in the past few days, I have been, I always do a little bit every day on my website, ecocult.com. So I have a few contributors and editors, and so I edit their work, and I, you know, do businessy things that happen when you are running an online business, less writerly things, research. I've also been interviewing some people and working on some stories. And yeah, what else am I doing? Also, like talking with my book agent about what my next book might be. So a lot of things simultaneously going on.
Gotcha. So right now, most of the writing you do is for EcoCult as well as working on books?
No, actually, I would say the majority of the writing I'm doing right now is freelance. So I have a few different, my most frequent clients right now are Wired. I love my editor there, Michael Kalor. And I'm also doing some work for Amanga Bay, Heat Map News. I have something coming out with BBC this week, which will be my first one for that editor who found me at Wired when she was at Wired. And then I'm also trying to pitch some more, but I just, it keeps getting pushed off to the side with all the other stuff. And then the writing that I do for EcoCult, I do probably one big article a month, and it tends to be the things that I know if I want to do it the way I want to do it, it has to be for EcoCult, and it would take me forever to pitch it around to some of these larger publications. So I just, I'm like, okay, I want to do this for myself, and I want to do it the way I want to do it.
Okay, so that gives us some sense of where you're at today. So now we're going to rewind and find out how you got to where you are today. And I like to start way, way back at the beginning. If you could tell us where you were born, a little bit about what growing up was like, and if anything planted the seed of interest early on in journalism or fashion or any of the things you do now.
So I was born in New Jersey, but when I was one, we moved, our family moved down to the middle of North Carolina, where my father's family is, and we stayed there until I was seven. My father passed away when I was three, and so my mom wasn't really, she wasn't a Southern lady, and part of that was, you know, what my best friend's mom likes to say, she was the only woman in our town with a subscription to Time and Newsweek. So I was always flipping through and picking up as much as I could at that age. I mean, you know, political cartoons and reading stuff like that. So we moved up to Maryland when I was seven. And I mean, everybody in our family are avid readers. And I'm loosely related to the reporter Tom Wicker, who was at the New York Times and wrote at least one book around politics. But I didn't really know that until later. But everybody in my family reads all the time. We read over breakfast. We read at night. We read on vacations. Like, we're just devouring books all the time. And also magazines and news and NPR and all of those different things. So I don't think I always thought I was going to be a writer or a journalist. But I have been sort of a little environmentalist for a long time. I stopped accepting extra plastic bags when I was in middle school because I read an article about peak oil. And I knew that plastic is made from oil. And so I really clearly remember being in the mall, and I had already bought something from Limited 2. And so when I walked into Claire's, I was like, no, I don't need a bag. I already have this bag. And like, I feel like that was a big deal at the time because like nobody was really doing it. But and I also, we lived in the middle of the woods for a long time. And so I was always tramping around, and I went to a summer camp in North Carolina in the mountains that was geared towards like gifted kids who care about the environment. So you can see how all roads led to being a journalist who writes about environmental issues.
For sure. How did, I guess, you start to write? Because it's one thing to consume books and be environmentally aware, but did you start writing for a school paper? Did you start find some other outlet?
I did. I wrote for, actually, do we have a school newspaper? I don't think we did in high school, but I did submit an op-ed to, I think it was like Annapolis Magazine, and it got published. It was about the stresses of being an AP student. and also, at that time, I was reading Vogue, and like Vogue was what pushed me into wanting to be a journalist. Not so, I mean, obviously fashion and the aspirational lifestyle and all of those things, but also it was just beautiful writing from my perspective. So in college, I majored in journalism and business, and I took over as editor of the school magazine, I think, I want to say my junior year, and ran that. And I was already starting to do like little investigative pieces through my magazine writing class. So I went to Washington and Lee. So I got my journalism degree there, undergrad, which I both recommend and do not recommend. I recommend it because I did not pay to go to post-grad journalism school, which I honestly think is a massive waste of money, unless, you know, people have told me who've been like, it's a really good way to make friends. Like, it won't get you a higher income after you graduate. It's a good networking tool, which can be useful, but it's very, very expensive program for what you get out of it monetarily. So I'm glad that I got my degree from a really good undergraduate journalism program. I really loved my professors. I don't necessarily recommend WNL as a college. I think it's named after Robert E. Lee, and it comes with everything, all the culture that that entails. And so it's not some place I would recommend that anybody go, because I don't think it's a healthy environment. And I did have to spend some time unwinding some of the things that I learned at that school from the culture, not from the professors. Professors were great. I definitely learned a lot around journalism ethics and just being a good journalist who serves society, and a lot of the skills and fact-checking and all those things. But the cultural stuff that I picked up there, again, I had to like consciously unwind some of that when I got to New York.
Washington Lee, is that in, where is that?
That's in Virginia.
In Virginia. So is it still DC area or is it farther away?
No, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's a little bubble. It's one of those little schools. It's in a little bubble in a rural area.
Gotcha. And just curious about some of the things you had to unlearn. I'll ask because I'm sure some listeners will wonder. I mean, is it just a bunch of white people in a bubble in the middle of nowhere? Or is that what you mean? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, it's at the time it was like 85% Greek. And the fraternities kind of ran the school, and the fraternities were run by wealthy white boys from Southern families. And there was some crazy shenanigans when I was there. So not the best place if you want to learn how to be in an increasingly global, interconnected, diverse world and workplace.
Gotcha. Okay. And the sort of kind of investigative stuff you were doing for the magazine, if investigative is the right word, what was it, fashion or clothing related or close to what you do now, or was it something else?
No, actually, it had nothing to do with fashion. I mean, there's only one fashion at WNL and it's preppy, but the one thing I investigated was there was no policy at the time barring professors from having romantic relationships with undergrad students. And there had been a scandal, rumors around that happening, a professor with a female undergrad. And the culture there was that I think he had to leave. She definitely got ostracized for it. And my question was, why isn't there a policy? And the school never answered my questions. I could never interview anybody from the administration. But that policy was quietly changed after the article came out. So I figure that's a win.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then I also did another article about the complete lack of any climate initiatives or environmental initiatives on campus. And I don't know if that had any impact because it's a conservative school. The party line was like, well, it's not really a priority here.
Still, I mean, yeah, getting a policy change, I mean, that's about as hard-hitting as journalism gets at the college level. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a little bit disappointed because, like, I couldn't get anything on the record. Like, as an investigation went, I couldn't get anybody to go on the record about things that had actually happened. So the incident that precipitated the story wasn't actually in the story. I mean, it's such a small school. It's like 2,000 people. So everybody who read the story knew exactly what precipitated it, but nothing was put in print.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So you graduate from college and do you move to New York right away or what happens?
So I graduated from college, yeah, and I moved to New York. That was 2009, the spring of 2009. But like, I went into advertising because even back then, as I'm sure you remember, there was already questions about, is the news business viable? And so I thought, okay, I will do the responsible choice for my finances anyway, and I will work in advertising. And so I took a bunch of classes in advertising and communications, and they made working in advertising seem super fun and creative. And that wasn't the case. I got hired at Ogilvy not long after graduating, which is a pretty respectable firm, very large. And I was so bad at my job. I didn't even apply as a copywriter. I applied as like an account person. And my job was to like input little data things into a spreadsheet so that digital ads could be served for our client, which is a financial services company. And I got fired after 8 months.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, you know what? That is fine. That is totally fine. Because I was like looking at my career trajectory and I was like, I feel so uncomfortable with what I'm doing. I'm not being a net benefit to the world. And also the job is just soul sucking. And I was like, it's not worth it. So I regrouped and I got an internship at Huffington Post. And this was when Huffington Post was on a tear and everybody wanted to work at Huffington Post. And so they had like figured out the secret sauce to internet publishing at the time. So I got this internship. I was in the green vertical. And so I was like pitching and writing slideshows. And at the time, slideshows were the thing that everybody was doing because it was all based on eyeballs. So if you have a slideshow, the page reloads, you get more eyeballs on more ads, and then you get more revenue. So it's just slideshows everywhere. And so my job was to come up with new ways to kind of make the connection between sustainability and cute animals. So I was always coming up with slideshows of adorable animals and like being like 11 adorable endangered monkeys from the African continent or something like that. And I would sneak in like other slideshows around like sustainable sushi, or one time I did a slideshow of like 12 newly designated Superfund sites, which are like the federal sites that are so toxic that they need remediation. And obviously that slideshow didn't do as well, but I really tried. So I was there for 3 months and then I realized like, oh, they're never going to hire me. Like they are just going to let me keep working for free for as long as possible. I think the employment laws have changed a little bit since then. So I left. I got a job at a place called LearnVest, which at the time was sort of, it came out of this, you know, everybody was founding media companies. So this was a media company devoted to personal finance for women. And so I had a really great team. I had a really great editor, Laura Shin, who I'm actually still friends with now. She'd come out of Newsweek. And it was amazing because it was a small enough startup where I got to immediately start writing articles. But because it was about personal finance, I was very heavily edited. At Huffington Post, nobody ever edited me. Ah. I would watch the comments because the commenters would point out errors I had made. And then I would go back and fix those errors. Because nobody, like, I would literally, like, I would write the slideshow and publish it. But there at LearnVest, I was being very heavily edited because if we made a mistake, people wouldn't trust us to tell them about money. Now, did I know anything about money? No, I knew nothing. But I was just doing all this research. And I mean, it was great because I was just like, okay, I'm going to learn everything I can about paying off credit card debt and sort of not even repackage it, like really come up with new content that synthesizes all the latest research around paying off credit card debt and make it really palatable and easy to read for the average reader who maybe doesn't know a lot about personal finance. So that was actually a really, really great experience. And I was there for a few years and then I quit. And
does that, I'm just curious, does it still exist? LearnVest, you said?
It does still exist. In what form? I'm not totally sure. They were bought by a financial services agency. I forget which one, so I don't want to say, but they sort of like went through this process of like trying out all the different things. They had a mint like budgeting product for a while. They had forums, like all these different ways to try. And then they had like a low-cost financial advisor thing, and then they were bought by a large financial service company. But that was after I left. But I ended up quitting because like it became really clear that like they stopped valuing the editorial. They just saw us as a cost center instead of we're bringing in people who might pay more. But it was just like a, you know. So I was already blogging at that point. It was the heyday of like everybody starting personal blogs. And so I shut it down and relaunched it as EcoCult. It was still a little bit of a personal blog, but it was more expansive. It was more like, okay, I'm going to do all this research and show you how to shop more sustainably. And it included fashion, but also beauty and a little bit of food and home stuff and travel. But fashion ended up taking over because nobody else was really writing about sustainable fashion at the time. That all changed when Rana Plaza collapsed in Bangladesh, which was the it was the garment center that when it collapsed, it killed 1,100 people. So suddenly everybody was talking about fashion sustainability, and I was very well poised to sort of not take advantage, but sort of ride that wave of interest and become one of the leading voices in fashion sustainability.
Sure, sure. So I guess you had to ask a bit more about the blogging. I mean, what are we talking? Are we talking like Blogspot or Tumblr, or had you picked up skills and were you doing like WordPress and all that? I remember all of us trying to learn that in that area. It sounds like we're about the same age. I also graduated in 2009, but how did you, did you know all that stuff? Did you just figure it out on the fly?
I learned WordPress in college, actually, because I wanted to set up a website for the magazine. And then I want to say Huffington Post was on WordPress. And I think LearnVest was also on WordPress. So like WordPress was just my platform. And I'm still on WordPress, actually. It still gets the job done.
Cool. Yeah, just curious. I mean, I at one point learned it, but I've forgotten everything, unfortunately. So Rana Plaza, yeah, that actually featured prominently in a past episode. This photographer Ishmael Ferdas did his kind of breakout project was about Rana Plaza. He's a photographer, though. So, yeah, huge event. Interesting to hear. I didn't realize that coincided with such an explosion of interest. How did that interest manifest itself? You were mostly seeing traffic coming into your blog. You were getting commissions. How did that happen?
So before that happened, Refinery 29 was the only publication that would let me write about fashion sustainability. So I actually was doing most of my freelancing around personal finance, which was more remunerative by far.
Sure.
So that was supporting me. And then when Rana Plaza collapsed, it didn't happen right away, but it was interesting because like I think so that was 2013. So there were a few posts on EcoCult that just tended to do better. And I think there just wasn't a lot of competition in terms of SEO for fashion sustainability. There was already a ton of food blogs, right? Like Michael Pollan was well established, the whole food movement. There were a ton of clean beauty blogs. There was one, and I forget what it was called, but like it like dominated. They shut it down, 5 or 6 years ago. But there was like tons of clean beauty content, and there just wasn't a lot of sustainable fashion content. I really thought that my role in the environmental movement would to just be to like educate people and tell them how to shop better. I've moved beyond that, and I can explain why. But in the end, it was just like, you know, just looking at the numbers, it was just the fashion content tended to do better. And so it just kept focusing more and more on that. And then I remember when I really realized that I could make this my freelance beat as well is my editor, Connie at Refinery29, recommended me to an editor at Newsweek. And he was like, tell me your ideas. And so I sent him a bunch of ideas that had nothing to do with fashion because I was like, he's not going to care about fashion. And then he was like, wait, don't you write about fashion? Like, pitch me a story about fashion. So I did. And it ended up like I still get text messages that like people like friends of friends in college courses are like reading this article. It was for Newsweek. God, I don't even remember the name, but it's just like around how unsustainable fashion is, which was still a new topic back then. And so I realized like, oh, okay, like, you know, like all the glossies even were starting to acknowledge that fashion has an environmental problem. It was no longer verboten or uncool. And so I've really established a niche. I have like my website now, not just EcoCult, but AldenWicker.com. Like I've really established myself as like a leading sustainable fashion journalist. So a lot of times when a publication does something on it, I mean, some publications will do one thing every 3 years. They'll come to me and say like, hey, can you do this for us?
So you founded EcoCult with the idea that you would write about sustainable fashion. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's always had shopping guides and, you know, buy this, not that. And then also what I call deep dives, which are answers to seemingly basic questions that haven't really been answered well before. Things like, why is polyester unsustainable? Or like, how polluting is the fashion industry? Things like that. And those do pretty well. The shopping guides always did the best, though. People just like to be told what to buy.
Sure. No, but I was more wondering, like, you had been working for a personal finance website, and then you leave and boom, you start a sustainable fashion website. I mean, that's a pretty bold move. Or is there another time? I'm just like to get to the root of, like, when was the first time you wrote an article about sustainable fashion, and what was it?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess the first article I wrote around sustainable fashion was actually for one of these content places where they don't pay writers called Elephant Journal. They do like a lot of yoga stuff. And I approached them because I had just gotten out of advertising. So I didn't consider myself a writer. And I was like, hi, like, I have an idea for a story. And they set me up with a login and I published a story. That wasn't about fashion, but I ended up writing a few other things around sustainability and fashion. Was started creeping in, and they just always did really, really well. And then I managed to sneak in a couple sustainability things at LearnVest, and then I pitched an idea to Refinery29, and Connie Wang, who was there, took me up on it. And so I think my real like first big freelance fashion article was for Refinery29.
Okay. And then this gave you the impression that, oh, if I start a website, the fact that some of these articles had done well gave you the idea that, oh, I might be able to make a whole site around this?
It was a combo. So I started one of those, like, those little blogs that were so popular, like, hi, like, I'm a girl that's new to the city. They follow along on my adventures, which people were interested in back then. And so I was doing that, but it was all around sustainability. But it was very not professional. It was called Clean Hippie. And I was like, okay, like, I really want to give this the attention that I think it deserves. And from working at LearnVest, I was thinking a little bit bigger. I never felt the confidence to go out and like solicit investment and make it a thing with a bunch of employees, which in the end turned out to be a benefit, I think. But I was encouraged by my editors to think more professionally about it and professionalize it. And I remember my one editor, Mariana Lynn, who's now, I think she's at Apple. She was like, look, nobody knows how small you are unless you tell them. So she was like, act as if. And so I shut down Clean Hippie and migrated only the best content over, got a new logo, got a new name, and really tried to make it look very professional and like a platform. And it worked. I think my first the first article that ended up doing really, really well actually was pitched to me by somebody who flaked out, but it was about whether Natural American Spirit organic cigarettes are actually sustainable. And the short answer is no. And that gave me a lot of confidence because it immediately started getting 10,000 hits a month.
Whoa.
And I would like meet people and they would be like, wait, you I read your Natural American Spirit cigarettes article. And I just realized there was so much power in just like answering simple questions for people in a really credible way, which is, are they good for you? Are they healthy? Are they like environmentally friendly? I think, you know, Vox picked up on that too, right? Like Vox does a lot of explainers that are just like, here, we're going to explain it for you. And EcoCult does that for a lot of these issues. So that gave me the confidence and direction to keep trying to do that.
Wow. Yeah, no, my boss, and I write about the environment, so the environmental editor spokes American Spirits. So I'll have to dig up that article and have a look. That's kind of funny.
It's probably outdated. Somebody finally did like a really interesting long form piece about the founder and everything he's been through and stuff. And I was like, okay, you deserve that. You can have the internet now.
Sure. And yeah, if you don't mind me asking, I'm just really curious, were you able to make money off this? Was this part of how you supported yourself?
A very, very small part of how I supported myself. The personal finance writing for like, just, you know, like content marketing writing was always more lucrative. Yeah, I want to say until like 2018, my husband and I actually both we decided we wanted to travel around the world, be digital nomads. So we bounced from low cost country to low cost country. He was freelancing and I was freelancing, and I took the opportunity that year to visit a lot of the countries that I had written about a lot in terms of fashion, but hadn't visited, because I knew that, you know, like people just like write about things. They have no idea what's actually going on. Like everybody has an opinion about Bangladesh and factories there. And I was like, I'm going to visit Bangladesh. So I did. And it really complicated the narrative for me, which is a really good thing. And I was really trying to pitch a story, like some stories out of visiting factories in Bangladesh and Vietnam. And I could never quite land anything. But those visits still inform my writing. And I met people that I can call up for different stories. And so I wouldn't say it was definitely worth it visiting them, even though I, you know, like it's so hard. I really respect journalists who, and I feel like it's getting harder and harder to do this, who like can get a trip financed somewhere. I've never been able to convince a publication to pay me to travel somewhere. I feel like that time is over. I just say no to a lot of offered trips and visits to places to see things I want to see, like cotton fields and factories and everything, because like I'd have to pay for this myself because of these rules around ethics and not accepting money or trips, but I can't afford it. I'm not going to get paid enough by any publication to finance this trip. So the answer is just going to have to be no.
Yeah. But that's an admirable line in the sand. I mean, I feel like a lot of people online these days blur those lines and accept free stuff and you find disclosures at the bottom and things like that. So yeah, that's admirable that you stick to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that you say that. I just think it's increasingly becoming an untenable situation, you know? Like, I really wanted to write about, I got this pitch that there was this swimmer in Ghana who was swimming up a river, and like they were collecting water samples to see what kind of toxins and microfibers were in the river, because Ghana is this infamous dumping ground for secondhand clothing from the Western world. And I was like, man, this would make such a good story. Like the lead, the visuals. Yeah, I would learn a lot. It's so cool. It's interesting. And I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't write for a publication that will pay me enough to do this, I think. I mean, now I might try to pitch it as a feature to Wired, but like there's a whole process for that. And I just feel like, yeah, my email is a graveyard of like really cool story ideas and sources who are like, I trust you to write about this. And I'm like, I would love to write about this. And, you know, I pitch and pitch and pitch and it just never goes anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, these days, yeah, I mean, there have always been grants and stuff. I guess they've gotten a lot bigger for environment, but still it requires a lot of hustle and like, you know, you know, getting one grant to do one story and maybe gives you a couple thousand dollars and covers your costs, but you still don't really come out ahead. It's really tough.
Yeah. And fashion isn't something that a lot of these, like I've looked at some of these environmental grants, and because a lot of them are based on like environmental issues that are in the US, and there's not a lot of production that happens in the US, there's not a lot that will like send me to Ghana or Bangladesh or whatever for things like this. And also because I've been so focused on consumers and consumer psychology and all of these different things that go into sustainable shopping for anything. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm coming off as so negative, but I always like to be sort of realistic, especially when I know that people are listening who might make decisions, career decisions based on what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to be realistic about it. And I think, yeah, no, we've had far more depressing episodes than this. So don't worry about that.
Low bar.
I mean, journalists aren't exactly the sunniest lot all the time. But I was going to say, yeah, no, a lot of stuff in your story, you know, reminds me of myself. Like I graduated in 2009. I moved to New York. I was broke and left after the litter agency I worked for did not hire me on after they gave me a little tryout, let me go. And yeah, I figured things out from there. And this whole crazy internet era where everybody was blogging and figuring things out. But yeah, it was grim. It was grim in 2009, like coming out into that job market. It still is. I mean, quitting your job, or not quitting your job, uprooting and becoming a digital nomad, especially in, I guess 2018 wasn't that long ago. It sounds like eons ago, but I guess people were doing it back then. I mean, it still seems like a pretty ballsy move, like a pretty big move. How long did you do that for, and where all did you go?
We did it for 14 months. We started in Mexico. We actually made a really good team, my husband and I, because he DJs. And so we strung together a series. So we started in Mexico, and then we went down through South America. And then between us, we were sort of able to string together some like cost savings and gigs as well. So like I would get us a free stay at an eco resort so I could write about it for EcoCult, and then, or like put it on Instagram, and then he would get us a free stay because he would like DJ somewhere. And then we separated. I managed to get a conference to pay for me to fly from Argentina to Copenhagen. I have never been able to do that again. But wow did it help.
Sure.
And he managed to get a DJ gig for his alma mater, Columbia, to pay for him to go to New York and then to Europe. So we like met back up in Europe. We spent some time in Berlin and Lisbon. And then from Berlin, we went down through Eastern Europe, or not quite Eastern Europe, but like we took that train ride that ended, we ended in Romania. And then I picked up a sponsored like content thing in Switzerland, which, oh my God, the most expensive place I've ever been, but great. And then we went to India, Bangladesh, and then Southeast Asia and Vietnam.
Okay, wow.
And then we went home.
In the span of how long?
14 months.
Okay, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, we moved really fast. I don't recommend moving that fast.
Yeah. So I was go, go, go all the time. I mean, you were taking pauses to write stuff up and kind of cranking it out, or did you come back with a ton of material, or how did you work it?
At the time, I was doing a lot less freelance because, I mean, I was doing a little bit of freelance, but so I want to say like between 2015 and early 2019 when we got back, I got really sucked into Instagram. I got on Instagram in 2013, because at the time, like, you just had all of your distribution channels, right? So you'd publish your posts to Facebook and to, like, whatever was big back then, Twitter, and then Instagram was another one. So it was just like, okay, this is another way to get more attention. And those social networks are so insidious because it ended up just taking over my life and career, because the way the algorithm worked was, it used to just be chronological. So I'd just be like, here's a picture, you know, and like, this is my latest post and this is what I'm thinking about. And then with it going out of chronological order and then tweaking the algorithm so that if your post didn't make people stop within a half second and interact with it, nobody would see it. And so it created this logic among me and other sustainable writers and bloggers and increasing influencers that I knew, of this logic of, I have to play this game so that I can get my very important message out. And so that was always the thing, like, I need to get my message out. And my message is important because it's around sustainability. And so I would spend, I mean, by the time we were traveling, it was really difficult for my husband, because I was essentially an influencer. And like, he had to be my Instagram husband and take photos of me. And to play the game, it had to be pictures of my face, and it had to be in locations. Like, I did all this analysis of what performed well. I was like, I don't know, pink or whatever. And then I was like, oh, wait. Oh, no. Like, the posts that do the best are the ones that inspire negative emotion, whether it's envy because I'm on a beach in Thailand with my wonderful husband and life is perfect, or anger because I'm posting about how vegan leather is plastic and, like, I prefer to buy leather artisan products, and getting the vegans really riled up and yelling at me. So I was doing a lot of, like, posts for gifts, posts for stays, sponsored posts, and then also earning affiliate income off of EcoCult. So when somebody buys something, it works the same way as Wirecutter. Somebody buys something that I recommend, or one of our contributors recommends, we get a small cut of the price. So that's where that income was all coming from. But my ROI on, like, where I was putting my work and energy and where I was getting income from was completely out of whack. And I was trying to make the travel blogger thing work. But as you can imagine, there is a lot of competition of people who want free stays for posts. And I remember I emailed a sustainable resort in Tulum, and they accidentally kept me on the thread as they discussed me. And basically, I just wasn't beautiful enough or aspirational enough for them.
Wow.
And, you know, I was really trying to educate people through my posts. I would spend a long time crafting these captions with a lot of information. I would post videos and pictures of factory visits of entrepreneurs and fashion designers that I met in India and Bangladesh and Cambodia and Peru and everything. And it really, I mean, I was not at my best, because obviously, like, it was taking an emotional toll. It was also just inherently narcissistic.
Sure.
If I posted a picture of somebody who wasn't me, especially if that person was brown, it would do worse. If I posted a picture that just didn't include my face, it would do worse. unless I piss people off. So you can understand, like, I saw what was coming, which was like, there were people coming into the sustainable fashion scene who were taking advantage of that. And I was feeling like, what am I doing? Why am I a part of the system that's making teenage girls feel bad about themselves? You know, is the message that I think I'm getting out around supporting artisans and buying sustainable things, is that worth the damage I might be doing through these posts of me frolicking on a beach in Thailand? You know, and I ended up, at the time I was president of an 80 person ethical writer and influencer coalition, and I was just trying to mama bear all of these women who were mostly younger, and a lot of them were getting attacked by some of these other new entrants. I mean, at the time I was like the biggest sustainable fashion influencer on Instagram. I was a big fish in a tiny, tiny pond. I think I had like 30,000 followers, which today is nothing. But
yeah, back then that meant something.
Yeah, it meant something. And, you know, I would get recognized. I'd be in Jaipur and this woman, like a woman came up to me and was like, oh my God, you're here. And I was in Berlin and this woman on this boat party was like, oh my God, you're here. And so I was recognizable amongst a certain type of people who cared about this, but
that must have felt good at least.
It did. It felt good.
I mean, it sounds pretty dark, all of it, but
yeah, it felt good. But like these new entries to the field were, they were just attacking people. And it was a really early precursor to a lot of what you see on the internet today, which is just like people can get a lot of engagement from attacking people. And I ended up getting canceled, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
So, yeah, I just got involved in drama. I mean, I can't even explain it because you know how internet drama is. It's like goes off in all different directions and it's impossible to explain. And if you try to explain it, people are like, I don't understand. But essentially, I just was like, just block the people who are attacking you. And so they marshaled their forces and followers and like ganged up on me and sent everybody after me. And so I got offline, regrouped.
Wait, like how does that manifest itself? Like people doxing you? Are we talking like that stuff?
No, not doxing. No, it manifests like hundreds of people flooding into my account and calling me a white supremacist.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I was very fortunate because I have a friend who ran social media for a large, like a very cool makeup brand. And this had happened in her world because she also is a knitter right before. And she was like, look, the only way for you to like stay in this community is by calling yourself a racist, apologizing, asking for forgiveness, and like telling everybody to go follow the people that attacked you. And she was like, I don't think you want to do that. And I don't think that's going to be good for you. And she was like, just get offline. Just get offline. And I did. And what was fortunate is that I had journalism to go back to. Actual journalism. Actual interviewing people. Writing stories that don't have my face. And I think it was good. Social media is really addictive, you know, and I knew I had a problem. You know, I was spending way too much time. My husband was just so mad. You know, he was just like, why are you on your phone? We're in paradise. I don't think I would have been able to get off it completely if I hadn't been forced off. And I don't think I would have written a book if I was still spending hours per day meticulously crafting images, or I guess making a ton of TikTok content or reels or whatever. It wouldn't have been possible.
Right. Wow. Well, cautionary tale. That's wild. Mm-hmm. I've definitely never talked to anybody who's gone through that. I don't think, at least. And I mean, you were going around the world in 2018, beginning of 2019. When does the shit go down on Instagram? Because we are getting in very close to the pandemic territory.
Yeah, it happened February of 2019. We had been back for like 2 weeks. And that was also a good thing because as soon as we were back, I fell back into a community of people who are like really diverse and very not online. But when everything happened in 2020, I kind of was like, okay, yeah, I've seen this before, you know, and I kind of knew how it worked. Like, I remember the, you remember the black square thing?
Yeah.
Everybody was putting up black squares because they felt like if they didn't put up a black square, they were admitting that they didn't support Black Lives Matter and that they were racist, right? And then you wake up the next morning and everybody's like, how dare you put a black square up? Like, and I was just like, oh yeah, I remember this. Like, I remember this like whiplash of like everybody being like, oh my God, if I don't do the thing, then like everybody's gonna think I'm racist. And then the next day being like, no, what you did was completely wrong and you need to apologize. And I was like, this is why social media is so terrible and the worst place to have these discussions, and why the best place to have these discussions is either in person, increasingly podcasts, obviously, because you can just have these nuanced discussions, or in a long format article without a comment section.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's always been Twitter, and I had a love or hate relationship with it, but I just felt like if I'm not there, then it just feels like I exist in a vacuum almost. Like, sure, you get numbers of people who read you, but, you know, I don't get a ton of emails, and it just felt like I had to be there, even though I often did not want to be there. I mean, now with the whole Elon Musk thing, I've basically, you know, stepped away from it. But I mean, I imagine especially for a thing like EcoCult and, you know, these smaller places, like social media was really essential for getting heard at all. But is there another way?
But let me tell you something really ironic is After I left EcoCult, I actually took the time to run my numbers and look at my Google Analytics, and I realized, oh my God, I'm getting less than 1% of my traffic from Instagram.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, okay, great. So I just wasted years of my life, and and now I can just walk away and not care about it. And that was really great, because also with Instagram, and especially if you're writing about fashion, there was just a lot of pressure to accept gifts from these fashion brands, and a lot of them are small and like wonderful, right? They passionate founders, and they're like, please, please, like, take this dress, and they want you to post about it. And I always felt so uncomfortable because I was like, you know, I hired a photographer. There was a photographer who just works with influencers, and I'd meet up with her in New York so I could take beautiful photos of this whatever Indian silk dress because I wanted to do right by these small brands. And that's not why I got into journalism. I remember when I was little, I was like, wow, being famous sounds like not very much fun. And here I was just plastering my face everywhere and hoping for engagement for the right reason, because I wanted to support these fashion brands, which were in turn supporting artisans. But it just, ugh, you know? And so when I realized that like Instagram actually wasn't sending me traffic and it was just eating away, like it just totally diverted me from my purpose and turned me into a person that I didn't really respect either, right? Like, what editor wants to hire somebody to write a serious investigative piece whose first job title is influencer, you know? And
true,
I was like, okay, I'm doing a rebrand, I'm getting away from this, and that's what I did.
Cool. Yeah. Good for you. And yeah, where did things go from there? I guess catch us up from then. So we're talking like 2020 to present.
Okay. So let's see. So 2019 was a year of contemplation and starting to really focus on like EcoCult's still going strong. I have contributors who are doing things, and we got shopping guides. I'm like really focusing on the numbers and making sure that what we're doing is giving us that return on investment, right? And I'm also pitching more, getting more stories out, developing relationships. I wrote a lot for Vox. Like, I did a couple feature stories that were really great. And then 2020, more of the same, pandemic happens. And my cousin, who's in Asheville, invited my husband and I to rent her and her husband's house while they built a tiny home. So we were like, sure. So we went down there, and in the course of that, I mean, I didn't have much writing to do that summer, because if it wasn't about the pandemic, then nobody wanted it. So
yeah,
I was one of the many people who like discovered my love of gardening, organic gardening, and, you know, hiking and all of those different things. And, you know, I shut down my social media completely. I had like kind of reopened it and was like cautiously looking at it. And then I was like, you know what? No, shut it down. And then I migrated all of that over to like an EcoCult account, and I hired somebody to just post for me. I was just like, just do it for me. I don't want to see it. I don't want to be like emotionally invested in all the drama that's always happening there and in the ethical fashion community. Just do it for me. And then what was really fortunate is that my favorite editor ever, Georgia King, who I wrote for when she was at Quartz. So I wrote some of my favorite pieces for her. I met her at a party where I cornered her in a hallway and pitched her a story, and she took it. And then over the course of the next few years, she pulled some of my favorite stories out of me. She pulled, I was just talking to her and I was like vetching about how conscious consumerism, I was over it. It wasn't working. There was no evidence. And she was like, wait, just do you want to write this for me? And I was like, yeah. And so I wrote this essay that totally went viral. 2017, Conscious Consumerism is a Lie. That felt really powerful. I wrote another one for her about LuLaRoe, which was the leggings multi-level marketing scheme. And I was the first one to sort of investigate it and be like, whoa, this is ruining lives. Unfortunately, Netflix, when they made a documentary, pretended that that article didn't exist, didn't interview me, didn't, you know, but whatever.
That sucks.
So anyway, she was my, But so she pulled some of my favorite stories out of me. And then in 2020, she became a book agent. And so she actually decided before she went back to Australia that she wanted to do a tour of the South. And I was like, well, make your first stop our place. So she did. And she was like, okay, great. What's your book idea? And I told her my book idea, which is that fashion can be toxic, and about how the flight attendants from a bunch of different major airlines had gotten really sick and there were some lawsuits. And she was like, she told me later she was really relieved because she thought I was just going to pitch a how to shop sustainably book. And this one was a lot more interesting. And so I was very fortunate because she just believes in me so much. And she just basically like walked into my life, and she's been this fairy godmother to me. And she sold the book to Penguin, to Putnam at Penguin, to an amazing editor, Michelle Howry. And then she was like, oh, I can't do this anymore because I'm in Australia. And she stopped being a book agent. So I got her for like the year that she was a book agent, and she launched me into books. So I signed the contract for that, or I sent the pitch over in the fall of 2020. And then I spent a year working on the book, which I signed for in early 2021. And then there were edits and everything, and it came out last summer.
So about 2 years all told?
Yeah, just about.
Okay, well, I mean, and that's a big undertaking. I mean, you had always wanted to write a book. I mean, how did, or it's just an opportunity that arose, and how did you take to the actual work of it? I mean, to so many people, you know, even journalists, like it seems like this, you know, monumental, gargantuan effort. How did you find it in reality?
I loved writing this book. How do I put this? So I had learned not to set big goals a while ago. And I think the pandemic really drove that home, where instead of setting these goals and saying like, I want to publish this much or earn this much or, you know, do this big thing or like write a book and have it published by whatever time, it was more about getting up every day and doing what you can to create a life and a career for yourself that you enjoy and that you're proud of. And what I'm about to say is going to sound very, very woo-woo. And I'm not a woo-woo person. I have a lot of friends who are very woo-woo. And among them, I am the cynic. But I will say, I went to a manifestation workshop January of 2020. And I was like, sure, whatever. It'll be fun. And the way this woman did it was, it wasn't about like, I'm going to manifest $100,000 or, you know, all that stuff. It was more about like, okay, we're going to meditate and then you're going to think about what your perfect day would be in a normal life. And I wrote it all down in a notebook. And at the end of the year, I was like, oh, what did I manifest again? Like, I wonder if any of it came true. And it was like, I joke that the workshop manifested the pandemic because everybody was manifesting country homes.
Yeah.
But it was really powerful because it wasn't just like, you know, when you set a goal, like publish a book, it could be really disappointing when you get there because you're like, whoa, nothing, like, okay, the book is published. Like, has my life changed? And it was more about, so I went back and looked at it and it was like, on my perfect day, I wake up in my country cottage and I make tea and my book editor like comes in from the city and we have lunch and, you know, and then I go to the farmer's market. And it was just like this life that I wanted. And at the end of the year, when I read that, I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Wow.
I never thought within 6 months I would be in a country cottage with an organic garden, because that's what my cousin does, with not my book editor, but my book agent having lunch with me and asking me what I wanted to write about. And like, there's a lot of luck in there. There's a lot of privilege in there, but it was pretty wild. And I tell people that I think manifestation can work not in a witchy way, but in a way where it provides clarity about what you actually want. I met Georgia because I put up on my wall all of the logos of the publications I wanted to write for. And one of them was Quartz. And my husband saw that, clocked it. And then when he met her at this cocktail party, he ran over and was like, there's an editor from Quartz here. I know you want to write for Quartz. You better go get her because she's walking out the door. So that's not witchy. That's not the universe. It's just clarity and telling people what you want and not making it ridiculous and just doing really good work so that when the door presents itself, you can walk through it.
Yeah. Wow. That makes sense to me, you know, not, it doesn't have to be pie in the sky, you know, you try to create the life you want. Wow. Well, and now I'm just curious. I want to hear how this cornering her went. Well, did you say already what was the story?
Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't. So at the time I had pitched a story to GQ and Cold Pitch and they were interested. And then they're like, somebody else is doing a similar story. I don't think I ever saw that similar story, but anyway, it was about this guy in New York who, he used to be a Perez Hilton style shit poster. He had this blog and he decided he wanted to start a sex party. And the sex party community at the time was not into it because, as you can imagine, a shit posting Perez Hilton style blogger is probably not going to be the safest person to start a sex party. So that was my pitch to her. I was like, hey, my name's Alden. I'm a freelance writer and I have a story to pitch you. It's about an entrepreneur who wants to start a sex party. And she was like, go on. And so that was the first story I wrote for her. And like, to her credit, my stories were always so much bigger than what Quartz wanted to do. And she would just be like, no, you guys don't understand. You have to do this story. And the stories would always do gangbusters. And then she would go back to management and be like, look, you got a bargain. Can you throw Alden a few more $100s? Because she just gave you a huge story. And so, like I said, she really believed in me.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. And yeah, okay. So you set about writing the book. I guess, yeah, where are things at with you today? Like, I mean, are you still living that life? Are you just kind of taking it as it comes? Do you already think you have an idea for another book, or where are things headed?
I mean, like I said at the beginning, we purchased this farmhouse in Vermont because I was like, great, more cottage writing. And that has proved a little bit difficult because my husband's also an architect, and now his office wants him back in the office. And so,
sure.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, the farmhouse has proved to be way more expensive to get even like basically up to code and functional than we anticipated. And so I ended up just putting it like on the short-term rental market. And so we haven't been up there in weeks, and we won't be up there for months. So basically just in Brooklyn, and I'm traveling a lot more than I would like because of book promo stuff, which is fun. You know, I'm getting all expenses paid trips to like Paris and London, which is good. And it's always great to have opportunities to talk about the subject of my book. But I don't particularly like travel. First of all, it's not very sustainable. It's tiring. I'd rather just get up every day and make my tea. But I am thinking about my next book. I think, you know, it's hard to say it's my first book, but I think this book, it did pretty well. It'll be a long time before it earns out its advance, unless something changes, if it does at all. But I know what my next book is going to be. The issue is that I need to convince the publisher of the topic of the book. So I would like it to be about the same thing as my current book, except for homes. So all the things that can poison us when we're inside our home. Polyurethane spray foam insulation, mold, which happens to, you know, it's somewhere around estimated half of all households have moisture and mold issues. It's extremely toxic, can ruin your life. Gas stoves, which I'm sure you've heard of. Vinyl materials, construction materials, paint, just all the stuff that can lead to serious health issues that take a long time to discover the cause of. It feels like the logical next step. Like, it feels like people are asking me to do this. Like, I've literally gotten emails from people being like, okay, do houses next. And a lot of people that I interviewed for my current book, it would start with carpeting or mold and progress to being sensitive to clothing as well. And so those stories I didn't end up using because this was a book about fashion, not about homes.
Right.
But it just seems like it's a huge issue. There's a lot that is covered, but there's a lot that's seriously undercovered. I did an investigative piece for Vermont Digger, which is a really great nonprofit news outlet in Vermont. And it was their most read story by far this past year about spray foam and insulation, and how it's increasingly getting put in houses because it's supposed to be the most efficient, and so it's seen as a climate initiative, but it ruins houses and it can lead to rotting out of the roof or the second floor, mold, air quality issues, all of these different things. So it just feels like it's the logical next step. And honestly, like, I feel like I've done everything. I've scraped out everything that I can get out of sustainable fashion. And I'm feeling a little bit done with it. And I would like to be able to move on. You know, before I wrote my book, Georgia, she's no longer my agent, but I remember at the time she said, I see you as being a Michael Pollan who gets really into a subject, does really well on it, and then eventually you get really into another subject. And I was like, that would be amazing. That is the life I want. So I need to convince my publisher. I've been working with my agent on an email back to my editor. She's lovely. Clearly, she had to consult with everybody at the office and collated their feedback into an email saying, like, no, we don't see it. This isn't your wheelhouse. You have a platform with EcoCult. It's about sustainable fashion. And so, like, stick to sustainable fashion. And I just feel like I did the topic in sustainable fashion, which is how it can make you sick. That is the most sellable motivating, new, electrifying, scandalous, all these different things. Like, I did the thing, and I just don't, I don't think there's anything else more to get out of it that will be as interesting and new as what I did. And so I'm really hoping that I can convince them to let me do this book.
Yeah, I hope they do let you. And yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, you've written about this for so long. You wrote hundreds of pages about it. Like, you know, you've extracted a lot from that subject. And yeah, I see how it could be diminishing returns. Okay, great. Well, I mean, that catches us up to present, really. So next up, we usually talk about some stories. So I like to start with the one that's a little bit more of a downer, about a story that got away. So a story you wanted to do but couldn't do for whatever reason. You couldn't convince an editor. It was in Ghana and you couldn't pay to go there, etc. It can really be anything, or something you did report out but didn't go right. It's just to kind of illustrate some of the challenges in journalism. Does anything come to mind?
Yeah, I did a story. I reported out a story in, I want to say, 2017. I was so excited. So there was this guy who got my name again from Connie Wing at Refinery 29. And they had installed him. I don't think this position worked out, but they had created this position at Condé Nast where he was supposed to bring in really good stories from, like, really good ideas from writers, freelance writers, and then farm them out to the best publication at Condé Nast. And so he brought me in for an idea meeting, and I pitched him a bunch of ideas, and he selected one, which at the time was really groundbreaking, which is MDMA is a good drug. It's not as toxic, addicting, damaging, dangerous as we've been led to believe. And actually, you know, at the time people weren't talking about it, but it was at the very beginning of MAPS doing a lot of their trials around PTSD, autism, all these other things that MDMA could do medically for people, and how it'd been used as a couples therapy drug. And so he was like, okay, I want you to do this story. And then he got back to me and he was like, it's going to be for Marie Claire. And so I think it was Marie Claire.
Wow.
And yeah. And I was like, great. And so it was really female focused, right? It was like, I interviewed some women who were like, yeah, it's changed my life for the better. This is the experience that I've had. I interviewed a Harvard researcher who had a study coming out about it. I revisited some research. There was like two studies that showed it caused brain damage, and one of them they accidentally gave them methamphetamine and then the other one sort of confounded X with like just the effects of going out and not sleeping and drinking alcohol and all these other things you do when you go out partying. And so I wrote this whole article, and I was so excited about it because I knew it would be a big article, right? I mean, I remember, just to put it in context, I was on a press trip to the Dominican Republic, and there was this guy there, I think he was a photographer, and we got in an argument. I mean, he was mad. He was like, how dare you suggest that MDMA could be safe? And I was like, I don't know, this is what the research is telling me. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And so I was like, okay, well, just wait. The article's going to come out. You can read the article and you can see what you think then. So submitted the article and he gives me back some edits. Cool. Then it goes to the editors of Marie Claire. This one editor just like rips it apart.
Oof.
Puts it back together. It's like large chunks of it aren't really my story anymore, but fine. That editor leaves. Another editor comes in, rips it apart, puts it back together. And I'm like, oh, geez. Okay. That editor leaves. Another editor comes in.
What?
Rips it apart, puts it back together. And I'm like, oh, my God. Whatever. It's factually accurate, even if 70% of it is not really my words. Just publish it. And then it died. This poor guy who commissioned it was like, I don't know. like, it's almost ready. They're just trying to get permission from the model, photography model, who they've, like, decorated up in Photoshop to make sure she's okay with it being on there. And then I, like, followed up, and he was like, I don't know. And then I followed up again, and he was like, I don't know. And then it disappeared.
Wow.
It disappeared. It never went out.
That's unbelievable. After the three edits. Wow.
Yeah.
It goes to show how much turnover there is in the magazine industry. Jesus.
I know. And also, like, I haven't written for a lot of women's magazines, but I mean, there's been a lot of jokes and stuff around. Like, I've seen things where it's like, if a women's magazine editor, like, edited a New Yorker article, and, like, just the comments and the ridiculousness. And I was like, yep, I see it. I see it. It's just like, it just felt like, I don't, this is crude, but like, they were just like pissing all over my article just to make it theirs, you know?
Yeah. That's definitely happened to me a few times, and it is awful. But when you're a freelancer, the dynamic's even worse. You really have no recourse whatsoever. But I was totally on board with your article. You had sold me on it.
They paid me for it.
Oh, okay. That's good, at least. But 2017, I mean...
They paid me for it, but like, that wasn't the point.
Yeah, yeah. Like, 2017, I mean, I'm trying to remember when... Like, now you could write that and nobody would be surprised, but like... That would have been very early.
Yeah.
That was before, like, New York Times and stuff were writing about it. Cool. Wow. Okay. And then I guess on a more positive note, we usually talk about a story you're proud of and how you went about doing it. You know, I thought maybe this is the time to talk about your book. Should we go that route, or had you thought of something else? Or
we could talk about my book. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Since we haven't really talked about it, I guess, yeah, I'll approach it just like a story in terms of, I guess we know how you came up with it, with the agent coming down. But I guess, could you just tell us a little bit about what it's about and how you set about doing it and kind of the process from the start until publication and the reaction?
So this topic about fashion being toxic first came to my attention because of the Delta airline attendant suing Delta. You know, at the time, I had been writing about sustainable fashion for a very long time. And I was just coming up against this feeling that, I mean, people would profess to care about it, but it wasn't really affecting them. And I had gotten into sustainability and blogging about sustainability essentially because of the food movement. You know, I read Michael Pollan, I read Food Inc., I read The End of Overeating, and I forget the author of that. But there was a lot in there that connected how our food is grown and where it's coming from with our health. And I think that was the power of the food movement, is like, people will just pay more for healthier food if they can afford it, because they don't want to get cancer. I mean, honestly, they want to be thin, but like, you know, like, they want to be healthy. And it's self-interested, but it's also good for the planet if you go shopping at the farmer's market. Community oriented, right? Like, you can see, if you go to the farmer's market, like, you're interacting with people and it just feels good. And I wasn't getting that in sustainable fashion. It doesn't feel any different to click buy on a cotton dress on one website versus another website. You can, like, read the whole story and everything, but in the end, it just, whether it emits a certain amount of emissions or positively impacts a garment worker, it's really hard to picture that. And it's the first thing to go when you care about how much money you're spending and whether it looks cute, whether it's on trend, whether you can get it tomorrow, if you're talking about Amazon. So I was just getting, like, really burnt out on that aspect of it. And so when I heard that these airline uniforms were making the airline attendants at Delta and then also Alaska Airlines and Southwest and American Airlines sick, I was like, okay, I've never heard of this being a thing before. Clearly something is happening, because it's happening at a large scale, documented to a lot of these flight attendants. And this is the way that I can tell people that how they purchase and what they purchase here affects them and affects people in the supply chain and affects the environment. And to make this connection between our health and the health of somebody that they're never going to meet, or the health of a river they're never going to see. And so that was really exciting to me. What also is really exciting about it is like nobody was talking about it. In the sustainable fashion world, in the wider world, it just wasn't something that I was like, okay, could this really be this thing that's so well hidden? And it turns out it was. A lot of people in the fashion industry, you know, not the designers, but like people in the fashion industry knew that this could be a problem. And so there had been work done on it, but none of that information had made it out to the wider world. And so it was such a juicy topic. There was corporate malfeasance. There was, I love writing stories about women who've been wronged by brands and corporations. And so it had that element. It had the fashion element. So I had this platform from which I could pitch the book, right? Because now publishers are looking for like, how many followers do you have? What's your social media presence? Newsletters, like website, all those different things. And so it was just the perfect topic for me to dive into. And when I put together the pitch, there's little clues here and there that I could put in there, but I was a little bit nervous. I was like, what if this isn't really a big thing? Like, what if it's a stretch? And it turned out not to be a stretch at all. And it was perfectly positioned because, so the first thing I did actually is I wrote an article for Harper's Bazaar about this. I didn't write at all about the airline attendants because Harper's Bazaar did not provide fact checking and they didn't do any edits on the articles that I wrote for them before it went live. So I was like, okay, probably not a good idea to expose these flight attendants to this type of scrutiny without a solid backing from a publication that deals with these kind of stories. So I just wrote a little, I wouldn't call it fluffy, but I wrote a pretty simple piece where I was like, hey, fashion can be toxic. And like, there's this evidence over here and they found PFAS in Thanks period panties and, you know, Greenpeace did something. And I mean, none of it was untrue. None of it was a stretch, but it was definitely like, okay, hey, guess what? Fashion can be toxic. I think it was 1200 words. And I used that as part of my book pitch. And I was like, this goes way deeper. We have the airline attendants. We have this through line. We have this plot. We have these characters that I can follow. And so it became the book that I, if I thought consciously about the book I wanted to do, it would be something like this, where it was serious, it was science-driven, it was investigative, it uncovered new stuff. I had been approached before to write How to Shop Sustainably, and I had turned down those opportunities because I was like, hey, it's been done, and like I'm not really excited about it. But this was exciting because I felt like I was uncovering something, and I felt it was as close as I could get to Omnivore's Dilemma or Food Inc., in the realm of sustainable fashion.
That makes sense. So how did you break it down? I mean, I apologize, I haven't read it yet. If it's an audiobook, I will get to it.
I actually read the audiobook myself, so you can hear my...
Oh, really?
If people are enjoying my voice, they can listen to me do the audiobook.
Oh, that's great. I'll check that out. Yeah, it's always good when authors read their own books.
I've read or I've listened to nonfiction books before that are read by voice actors, and apologies to the voice actors. I think they're great for novels, but it feels a little bit like I'm being read to by Siri. And so I decided that I wanted to do the whole book myself.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, yeah, I was going to say, I haven't read it. If you could just explain, like, you know, a book's a major undertaking. Like, how did you break it down and tackle it? Like, you came up with the structure and did you do all, like, say, the reporting first, or did you report and write one chapter, then move to the next? Yeah. How did you work through, you know, a big work like this?
Yeah, I definitely had to break it down into pieces because I had 1 year to write it and it was a huge undertaking. And so the first chapter, let's see, I think I'd have to look at the book proposal because the final book doesn't look exactly like the book proposal. But of course, in the book proposal, you have to put all of your proposed chapters just so they can get an idea. So I actually had the option of turning in an entire finished book or turning it in chapter by chapter. And I chose chapter by chapter. And thank God I did, because my wonderful editor, Michelle, would look at the chapter and she offered feedback. And so the feedback she gave was, the first chapter was way too big because I went through all of the airlines. I went through first Alaska Airlines, then American, then Delta, then Southwest. Like, I really got into the stories of each of them. And she was like, no, too many airlines, pick one. So I picked Alaska because it was the first one that happened. And so it had this element of mystery, right? What's going on? What are the chemicals? Why is this happening? Nobody knows. It also had, there's two characters, two attendants who got very sick. One of them ended up passing away. And then...
Oh, wow.
And then the next, the other person involved was the industrial hygienist at the Association of Flight Attendants. So the union that represents flight attendants from Alaska and some other airlines. And she was this quiet hero working to figure out what was going on and protect the flight attendants from the uniforms. She was absolutely wonderful and worked so well with me. But yeah, so I did that. The next chapter I spent way too much time on again, and it was the history of toxic fashion. And so that was really fun to do because I just got to go to the library at Bryant Park and check out all these old books around mercury poisoning and dyes and everything, and I really nerded out on it. Again, I had to cut a lot from that because I did have a bunch of stuff about the different Superfund sites in the U.S. that were dye factories and stuff like that. But in the end, it was just too much, so I had to cut that out. So there was like a lot of work that I did that I couldn't even include, but that's okay. That's okay, because it was a really great process. And I think if I were to do another book, like now, I know better. And so the first three chapters ended up being Alaska Airlines, what's going on, and then sort of a cliffhanger, and then the history of like heavy metal toxins and finishes and stuff like that in fashion. So starting off with mercury in hats, the Mad Hatter, and then going all the way up to PFAS, which is the so-called forever chemicals that are used to waterproof and stain-proof and Teflon, and that have been in the news a lot lately because it's in drinking water and children's school uniforms, and it's carcinogenic and reproductive toxic and all these things. And then the next chapter was dyes. So the invention of fossil fuel dyes all the way up to today and the research on that. And then I get back into different characters. So every chapter basically had a character. So even the history chapters, I was talking about a royal in France who everybody thought was poisoned by her gloves, and a hatter who committed suicide. And all the other chapters were contemporary people that I interviewed about how they got so sick from fashion. So a production manager at a fashion brand in New York, and I interviewed researchers who had all this cutting edge research coming out around the toxicity of dyes and other finishes. And a lot of it, I mean, I had to find these sources as I went because there's no line of communication between the researchers who are doing this work and the sustainable fashion world. It's like they don't know that they exist. I don't know why the press reps at these universities aren't emailing like the fashion publications and being like, hey, we have new research around the dyes used on polyester, but they're just not. And I also had to go back to researchers because in 2019, I had emailed some researchers, and I remember one of them, Heather Stapleton, was like, I don't know anything about fashion. And then I went back to her because another researcher was like, no, I swear, you should talk to her. So I went back to her in 2021 and she was like, oh, I'm so glad. We just did a 5-year research project on dyes and I would love to talk to you about it. So there was a lot of hunting down and cold emailing and finding the handful of researchers who are working on this, you know, who are taking this seriously. And yeah, it was difficult. It's just researchers don't tend to take fashion seriously as a topic. I think there's sexism in there. And then the fashion industry doesn't really like talking to researchers because they're not very aspirational. So I sort of act as a go-between. I'm the dorky person who likes to wear fun things that can talk to fashion and can talk to the researchers.
No, that's awesome though. And I mean, you managed to do this all in a year. That's pretty impressive. Was it, just to get a sense of what your life was in that period, I mean, were you working like crazy day and night, or was it a doable amount of work? You just scaled back what, you know, the other work you did, or how was that for your life?
Yeah, I didn't have a social life. I just told all my friends I will see you in a year. So I was just doing a ton of research, a ton of writing. I also went to India. I self-funded a trip to India. I used my entire first quarter of my advance to go to India to visit dye houses. I remember my editor was like, that's ambitious. And I was like, I just have to go. Like, I was very sensitive to the potential charge that I was just focused on the experiences of, you know, white shoppers in America without talking about how this is affecting garment workers. So I was like, I'm going. I also used my advance to do some testing of clothing, which was really expensive. But anyway, so there was a little bit of traveling, but most of my life was being up in Vermont in a very cold, old farmhouse and just getting up every day and working on the book and then also doing stuff for EcoCult to keep that going and then occasionally doing some freelance articles as well.
And I guess then let's talk about the release. So it comes out last year, right? In the middle of last year. And
yeah, in June.
What was the reaction like? What was promoting it like? Yeah, just give us a taste of how it went with the release.
From what I understand, this is pretty rare, but I felt very well supported by the team at Penguin Random House. They hooked me up with a bunch of radio programs. So I did a ton of radio program interviews. They ended up getting me on to Fresh Air, which was a highlight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, very exciting.
What are you doing talking to me? Like, you talked to Terry Gross? What?
I didn't talk to Terry Gross. I talked to her.
Oh, okay.
Her co-host. I talked to Tanya Mosley, who is an amazing co-host. And apparently she picked up the book, or she got the book and she read it and she found it really interesting and wanted to have me on. So that was a huge compliment.
Yeah, awesome. Wow. I mean, I have a coworker who just published a book, and like, so it's been interesting to see like what a successful, her book is successful. It's getting traction and things like that. But I guess like I used to have this idea that you'd publish a book and it would like change your life. And I get the sense it's not that.
No.
And it's also not like extremely lucrative or anything, but a very rewarding thing. I mean, I don't know where the question is in there, but basically like
yeah,
your book's done pretty well. And yeah, what does that mean, I guess?
So what that means, well,
has it changed anything for you? Or go ahead.
Does it change anything for me? Not in a huge way. So is the book a success? I've sold a bunch. I mean, it's definitely not a bestseller. Like I said, I'm not going to earn out. I don't think I'm going to earn out the advance, but very few people do. So that's a pretty high bar. And I've been a bunch of podcasts. I get really, really sweet emails from people who are just totally bowled over by the book because I'm naming something that's been happening to them and they've been told isn't real. And that's amazing. I mean, the fact that I can name this thing and then help people manage their health, because I mean, the book makes the case, this very strong case, that I think that chemicals in clothing, which thousands of different chemicals, are connected to all the things, reproductive harm, right? Infertility, eczema, cancer, autoimmune disease, thyroid illness, all of these different things. And so I feel very proud that even if 100 people read the book and make changes to their lives because of it, like that's a really real impact. Yeah, that's been very satisfying. In terms of compensation, I got a pretty good advance. I was told that my agency was expecting more because they pitched it as a women's health book. And they think that the publisher was splitting the difference between a fashion book, which doesn't sell, and a women's health book. But still, I mean, it's basically spread out over 4 years because you get something on signing, which I used all of it just to do the book. And then you get something upon submitting it, which is a year later. And then you get something upon publication, which is like 8 months later. And then you get something a year after publication. So it's spread out over 4 years. So it's, first of all, it's not a livable income, especially if you're using it in order to fund different reporting aspects of the book. And then on top of that, they offered to pay for like one in-person book tour date because it was within like a few weeks of the publication. And it was in Vermont, so I didn't even need them to pay for it because I was like, oh, no, this is just the bookstore that's a half hour from my house, so it's fine. I could have lied and been like, yes, please put me up at a hotel. But so the rest of there were digital book tour dates, which I think just have a larger return on investment because you can just talk to a bunch of people at once. And there have been in-person book tour dates since then within driving distance, which have been lovely at libraries and such. And then there have been a few where I traveled for them. So I sort of, they helped me schedule this, but I proposed and I had to pay for. They do this thing where they're like, yes, of course. If you can get yourself there, we will arrange that like bookstore talk you want to do. So it really is just a way to like deduct travel expenses for seeing my friends. So
sure.
I went to San Francisco, stayed with a crash with a friend, and then I went to Phoenix where I have family. And I also thought that there would be a good market for it there because a lot of people move to Phoenix or the desert because they are chemically sensitive. And I was right. It went really, really well. There was a lot of people there, so that was great. But yeah, not terribly remunerative. And I would say that this is a really low bar, but I would say actually, I just need to do the math because I haven't looked at how many hours I've put into this book, into writing it, researching it, promoting it. But it feels off the top of my head like it's paying me the same low amount per hour of work that I get for doing an article. And the promotion and everything about it feels like a particularly intense, and the feedback feels like a particularly intense round that I get from an article that goes viral, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, that does.
Yeah. So not life-changing.
No, I appreciate you being so open about it. I mean, a big point of this podcast is just to kind of demystify things for people. So yeah, it's good to hear what it's really like. So next up is the lightning round. Do you feel ready?
Yes. Yes, I do.
The first question is a publication in your area or the area you write about that you consider particularly good that you would like to shout out.
So the publications that I subscribe to that I get the most information from, I actually really like Sourcing Journal. It's a trade journal, but I really admire Jasmine Chua, who edits a lot of their sustainability content, and it's accurate and it's good and they get into the weeds, and I rely on it a lot to inform me of what's going on in the sustainable fashion world.
That's exactly the sort of thing I'm looking for that, you know, I can't say I've heard of it, but I believe it's out there. I believe they're doing a good job, and I think more of those publications deserve to be highlighted. What is a publication, journalistic in nature, that you read, listen to, or watch for fun? So it can be any medium, kind of journalistic.
I will say, actually, I read a lot of Washington Post. I actually unsubscribed.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, I unsubscribed, and then I got pulled back in because I was just like, oh, man, you know what? I really want to read this. And they do good work. I've actually never written for them. I actually tried to write for them once, and it didn't work out. The story got killed, but they do a lot of good stories. Some of them intersect with what I do and some of them don't. And I also really like the advice column they have there. So, and their comment section is remarkably good. They must do very good moderation.
Which advice column, out of curiosity?
Carolyn Hacks. It's just like life advice, relationship advice and stuff. And it's so interesting and so good. And it's sort of a conversation starter, actually. I read all of them immediately.
Yeah, that does sound fun. And then to get a little more specific, what's the best journalistic article, piece, video, again, whatever medium that you've consumed recently?
I would say In the Shadow of Silicon Valley by Rebecca Solnit. I think she has a book coming out, and that's why she's had a few pieces like this come out. Essentially, it's this essay that it's about an extremely controversial topic, which is San Francisco and whether it's a bad place or a good place and who's to blame. And she fit it really neatly into this strong framework that it felt so true. It really felt like we're 50 years in the future and looking back on this time in a history book. And then her framework, it just feels really true to me. And it feels like a lot of the things that I've been thinking about personally, which is just how technology has decimated our ability to build real communities and has also destroyed cities because all of these little communities have fallen away. You can't get anything locally anymore. You don't meet people in person. And then puts it into this thing where it's like, it's a pretty dark essay. I mean, there's some real darkness in there, and not just about homeless people, about the kind of people who are running these tech companies and the kind of people they are. And she's not waving away homelessness and drug use is not a problem, but she's saying, like, look, these tech lords have created this problem, and now they're upset about it, and they don't realize that this is their doing. And it crystallized a lot of the feelings I've been having. And, you know, I've mentioned that we have this place up in Vermont, and one of the things I love about this house in Vermont is that we're in a town of 500 people, and you could not accomplish anything on the internet if you tried. The only way to find a contractor, to find a service, to find a thing, to get food or anything is to go down to the general store and talk to people about it. And it's so community oriented and so hostile to the internet. And that's why I love it so much. Is it uncomfortable sometimes? Yes, absolutely. Sometimes I just want to order Seamless to the house, but I have to go to the grocery store before it closes and get food, and my life is better for it. So anyway, that's a very long answer to that question, but I really, really liked that reported essay by Solnit.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I lived in San Francisco for a summer. Magical city, great geography. I hate most of the people who live there. So I'm of the opinion that San Francisco, like just the whole tech scene is, don't want to be there. Is there any particular subject matter you geek out about that isn't related to your job?
Yeah, I've only written a couple stories about this because I find it so fascinating, but the whole Burning Man culture and everything it entails, sex, drugs, rock and roll, or electronic music in this case, I don't write about it very often because I'm too close to it. When I have written about it, like, people get mad because they're not expecting, like, one of them to, I feel a little bit like Truman Capote, like I've just betrayed everybody by like writing honestly about what I'm seeing. So I've written a couple articles for Wired about Burning Man and how it's not climate friendly at all, and it makes me really uncomfortable in that way. And, you know, I don't really see myself going back because of all these things. And, you know, and I told you earlier that the story that got away was about MDMA. And if that had gone live, like, I'm just wondering if my career would have taken a little bit of a different trajectory where I'd be writing more about, you know, the psychedelic renaissance and the good and the bad of it. But my life didn't take me there. And then also, I, you know, I've written about sex parties as well, sometimes under my byline, sometimes under a pen name. So I find all of that counterculture stuff incredibly fascinating. But again, like, I don't pitch and write about it very often because I just think I'm like too close to it. I'm friends with too many people where, you know, I see some crazy things and I'm like, I just don't want to know. I don't want to know. I just want to enjoy myself at this party without having to sit down and write something that's going to hurt everybody's feelings and make them never want me to be around me again. Like, I have a lot of friends who are like, you better not put this in a story. And I'm like, I'm not writing about this. Like, I'm not writing about it. It's fine. I promise. I would tell you if I was writing about it. It's not page six. But I find it fascinating. And I will sit down over a cocktail or a coffee with anybody one-to-one and talk about this philosophically all day.
Yeah, no, I'm interested. I want to hear about it, but we'll leave that for another time. And yeah, I mean, I have a couple of burner, at least. Yeah, I have a couple of burner friends. And I do remember this last time around with those, I think it was Extinction Rebellion protests, that I was like, just sent it to one of them, and they can be very, very sensitive about the environmental aspect of it, even though I'm like, I'm not attacking you, like, but like, think about it, like, logically it's not great, but anyway, for the environment, I'm not saying, you know, people shouldn't do any, would never do anything if it, you know what I mean. Anyway,
yeah, the one story I wrote last year for Wired, it could have been a feature. I should have pitched it as a feature, but it went viral. It was really well read, and like the people in there was a couple of people I interviewed who were just really upset. The Burning Man org was also incredibly upset about it, and I was just like, do I want to go through this all the time? No, like maybe I want to have a space where I can just enjoy myself instead of making it like part of my career and like stressing myself out about managing all these different personalities.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you had to trade places with one journalist living or dead and you would have their career, who would it be?
I would say some combination of Elizabeth Colbert and Michael Pollan. So Elizabeth Colbert, she's a regular contributor.
She's the Under the White Sky. Is that
Under the White Sky? She wrote The Sixth Extinction, and she's a regular contributor to The New Yorker. So she does a lot of...
Yeah, Colbert did write on... She did write Under the White Sky, so I've read that. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, she did. Okay, yeah. Yeah, she just does these like huge stories that are gorgeous and push sort of the pop culture understanding of whatever environmental crisis she's writing about forward. And I really love that. And then obviously Michael Pollan, because he just gets to get into these really interesting topics and then like mine it for all it's worth and become like the face of it and change minds and change lives and then move on to the next thing and do the same thing. And I want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Who doesn't? I mean, for me, it's always been more Michael Lewis, but it's a similar deal. Like, yeah, pick something, get really into it, move on to the next thing. What is one thing most people don't know about you?
I could go so many places with this. I think a lot of people don't. Okay, there's two different, completely different things. So a lot of people who know me in person know that my husband and I are in an open marriage. And so like all this stuff talking about polyamory, we're like, yeah, yeah, cool. And I've written about it under a pen name, but like the only reason I don't put it out there so much is I just don't want my family to know about it. But I'm pretty sure my mom doesn't listen to these things. So
sure.
So like the general public doesn't know that about me. My friends, on the other hand, are shocked when they find out that I was a preppy Southern sorority girl. They're like, how did you get from there to here? No idea like how I went from pearl wearing to where I am today. So those are two things that are surprising for people to find out.
Yeah, interesting. What's your most embarrassing journalism-related story?
So this one time, I emailed an editor at a large publication, and I was like, hey, somebody told me this rumor about a factory owner, and I would like to explore it and see if it's true for your publication. I CC'd the factory owner in that email. Yeah, I did that thing where you're like trying to remember their email. And so you like type it in for autocomplete. And then I just didn't delete it. And so he emailed me and he was like, that's not true. He was very polite about it. He was like, that is not true. And the person who told you that has an interest in spreading rumors around me about me and blah, blah, blah. So then I had to email the editor and like admit to her that he's on that thread before she responded. The story did not get assigned. But I learned a valuable lesson that day. It was very cringy.
Wow. Wow. What is the coolest place, situation, or what have you that your job has taken you to? I call it a pinch me, I can't believe it. This is my job moment. So...
Yeah. So some years ago, I pitched a story to, I don't think this magazine, I don't even think it exists anymore. It was called like The Good Something. It's one of those online publications, and yeah, they don't exist anymore. But I pitched a story, and I wanted to write about this like sex positive co-living situation that throws sex parties called Hacienda. I had never been to one of their things. They're wild, apparently. Not really my style. But like, I knew people around, and I wanted to write a story about one of their parties as a vehicle to explore. This was like 2017, to explore how this like new generation of people were doing this as opposed to like the swinging 70s. And so I pitched in this story, and speaking of travel, they were like, okay, we'll pay you this much. I think they're going to pay me like $800, and you can report on this story. Well, their next party was in New Orleans. So instead of being called Hacienda, it was called Maison. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to go to New Orleans with my husband. We'll have a good time. I'll like pay for it with the fee that I'm going to get when it gets published. And we'll like go to this party. And I found myself in the kitchen of this mansion. And there was this guy dressed as the Swedish chef from the Muppets. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like naked except for boxers and like the mustache and the hat, the toque, with a pot and a rubber chicken, spanking this girl who's crawling around on the floor with cat ears meowing. And I was like, I cannot wait to write about this moment. I mean, there is nothing sexy about this situation whatsoever, but it is entertaining. Anyway, so I get back to New York and they were like, we're killing the story. And then I think they went out of business like 6 months later. So I never actually got to write about it, but it was fun imagining that I would get to write about it.
Yeah. You have like in another world, you'd have like a totally gonzo style career. I mean, writing about drugs and these sorts of things. But
I know. I was talking to my husband a few weeks ago and I was like, you know what? I could probably make a lot more money if I just started a Substack about this stuff and charge people to hear about these crazy things. Probably not the direction I want to go in, but the thought has occurred.
Yeah. It can be a late career step or something once you've done everything you want to do.
Yeah.
And then what is your favorite film, book, TV, or other media property about journalists and why?
Yeah, I really like the book She Said by Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey. They're the New York Times journalists who broke the Harvey Weinstein story. And I actually haven't seen the movie. I don't think I want to see the movie. I mean, unless you have a differing opinion, but it was just really good to read a play-by-play of how they pursued this really delicate story and got their sources to open up about something when they have somebody with so much power and money breathing down their necks. And it was really instructional and inspiring. And especially because some of my favorite stories that I've done have been about women and how they've been mistreated by the system, whether it's a multi-level marketing company or toxic uniforms at the airlines or something else. And I really appreciated seeing how they approached treating these women with a lot of dignity and respect, being honest with them about the fallout that would happen once they went public with these allegations, and winning their trust so that even after the story came out and the fallout did happen, that these women still appreciated these journalists and trusted them and saw the importance of what they did.
And then, qualifications aside, if you couldn't be a journalist, what job would you do?
I'd be a professional organizer.
Cool. For like political movements, unions, what?
No. No. I would have an empire where I would help people organize their homes. Like, I love organizing.
I realize. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, no, actually, that's really funny. Totally, you would think that. No, I like every time a friend is like, oh, my closet's a mess. I'm like, oh, let me come over and help you organize it. So that's probably what I would do.
Gotcha. No, it also comes from me. My dad was like a labor organizer his whole life. So that's where my mind goes when I hear organizer, but I get it.
Organizer of stuff.
Yeah. There's a simplicity to organizing stuff. Yeah. There's a simplicity to it that would, yeah. A lot of people pick jobs that it's like they can set aside all the journalism stresses. And that sounds like maybe one that could do that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that's all the questions. So I guess I'll just wrap up by saying thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Alden.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really great.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Alden Wicker, a freelance journalist and author of To Die For, How Toxic Fashion is Making Us Sick, and How We Can Fight Back. I'll post links to some of the things Alden talked about in the podcast description and also on our show page, foreignpod.podbean.com. If you like this episode of Foreign Correspondence, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts, and give it a rating. Beyond that, it would be a huge help if you also write out a review saying what you think about the show. It helps get the podcast more attention. Follow or tweet at me on Twitter at foreignpod. On Facebook, our page is facebook.com/foreignpod. Above all, if you know someone who might like the podcast, please recommend it to them. The show is produced and edited by me. Our music is a track called Love Chances by Makai Beats. There's more information on that in the podcast description and on our show page. Please look out for my next episode to drop sometime in the next couple of months. Until then, I'm Jake Spring, and this is Foreign Correspondence.